countries where it's involved in the Middle East.
Israel does not only use drones to sneak into the Lebanese airspace. Its U.S.-made F-35 stealth jets have also violated the country's airspace multiple times. In late January, Lebanese media said the Israeli regime used F-35 and F-15 warplanes to fly over the cities of Nabatiya, Eklima Tufa, and Tyre. They said it was the first time F-35 jets were used on such missions and that the flights were conducted at high altitude. Israeli aircraft has routinely breached the Lebanese airspace since 2000 when the regime was forced by Hezbollah to withdraw from Lebanon's south. The Lebanese government has filed hundreds of protest letters with the UN over airspace violations by Israel since the 2000 withdrawal. The letters have failed in ending Israel's almost daily breaching of Lebanon's sovereignty. Observers say Tel Aviv's overflights could be meant to send a message to Lebanon.
Well, I think that Israel views Hezbollah in Lebanon as a prime rival and a prime opponent. So Israel continuously sends its F-16s and F-35s over Lebanon. It also sends them up to attack Syria. So I think that I don't know that they're sending a message about the drones, but I think that they really want to track what Hezbollah is doing. They want to find out what plans it has. They want to track any missiles that may be coming through Syria into Lebanon so that they can keep track of that for the next time that there's a war, an invasion by Israel of Lebanon.
Israel has waged numerous wars against regional countries since it was installed in West Asia following World War II. The regime enjoys full support from its Western creators, most notably the U.S., Britain, and France. The U.S. alone has used its veto power at the U.N. Security Council many times to shield Tel Aviv from the full force of international law. This has further emboldened the regime to continue down the path it started in 1948.
When the United Kingdom handed over control of Hong Kong back to the Chinese in July 1997, various agreements were made in order for the island to maintain some kind of autonomy. However, over two decades later, Hong Kong is very much an integral part of China, and hence why China sees all affairs surrounding the island as sovereign business. Yet, following the implementation of the National Security Law, preventing a variety of crimes, including secession, subversion, terrorism and collusion, the UK promised to issue eligible Hong Kong residents citizenship to Britain, something that Prime Minister Boris Johnson has recently reiterated he will honour. The ability for Hong Kong residents to apply for the special visa may see hundreds of thousands of people apply to travel, live and settle in the UK, and has seen immigration offices in Hong Kong see a surge in demand for applications as the process begins to fall into place. However, China has taken offence to the offer by the British, with the Chinese Foreign Affairs spokesman Zhao Linjian stating that the move grossly interferes with Chinese internal affairs. He further stated that China will no longer recognise BNO passports as valid travel documents. Furthermore, Chinese authorities are baffled as to why residents would want to leave Hong Kong and head to the UK, claiming that once they arrive there, they'll be considered as second-class citizens, something that China may very well have a point on when one considers the levels of discrimination and racism against foreigners in Britain, meaning that new arrivals could fast become targets of British anti-hospitality, something that the Brits have a long and tarnished record of. What now remains to be seen is just when and how so many new residents will make their way over to the UK, in particular as Britain faces the toughest ever travel measures amongst the peak of the COVID-19 virus, which has already killed in excess of 100,000 British people already. As Britain comes to the stark realisation that leaving the EU may have caused more problems than benefits, it seems that one thing that was not calculated was a sudden resentment towards Europeans, in particular Eastern Europeans, who made up a significant percentage of the low-skilled workforce in Britain, meaning that many EU citizens felt they were no longer welcome in the country.
During my previous 6 years in the UK, I was contributing to the economy here. I cherished Britishness. I worked in companies such as Barclays and subsequently British Airways, as most of my working life has been concentrated on public sector. And then one snap decision destroyed it all, and suddenly I felt, you know, I actually do not belong here. I am no longer welcome.
It's hence why Britain needed to find an alternative source of labour to fill the void as Europeans leave the UK and head back to their home countries in the European Union. And hence why Boris Johnson, when asked what he would do about the Hong Kong situation, saw an opportunity waiting to be developed. Boris Johnson is no doubt using the opportunity for BNO status holders in Hong Kong to find a way into the UK, and hence why suddenly, unlike European citizens who no longer feel welcome, he claims he's proud to allow the people of Hong Kong to live and work in Britain. After all, his economy depends on having a wide range of workforces. So bad is the labour drain in Britain that the number of Europeans having left the country has seen EU citizens' levels in Britain at their lowest for over 5 years, meaning that more people are leaving Britain than actually entering the country. And with Brexit being such a dividing topic in Britain, the government have gone one step further by secretly adding EU nations to the so-called voluntary return scheme, which actually pays EU citizens to get out of Britain, covering their flight costs and also providing £2,000 in a cash envelope in the process, showing just how deep Britain's discrimination and hatred of the EU really is. What now remains to be seen is whether the people of Hong Kong are genuinely willing to fall into the trap that their Eastern European predecessors managed to escape from in Britain, and whether actually leaving Hong Kong and truly becoming second-class citizens is better than living in their own country.
The coronavirus pandemic battered the global economy like nothing else has done for decades. Prolonged nationwide lockdowns in some countries and mismanagement of the crisis in others have all contributed to 2020 becoming one of the gloomiest years for the global economy. It's not surprising to learn, according to a new report from the International Labour Organization, that workers around the world have lost $3.7 trillion since the pandemic began. Globally, 8.8% of working hours were lost, and 114 million people experienced employment loss, what the report called an unprecedented level. What's shocking is another report that made headlines. Billionaires around the world, who initially suffered massive losses like everyone else, have seen their wealth increase by $3.9 trillion as the entire globe has been grappling with the impacts of the deadly respiratory disease. That figure, according to the Oxfam report, is enough to vaccinate every single person on Earth against the coronavirus and help them stay out of poverty.
It's a new normal, but I don't think it's a sustainable new normal. So the level of increase in wealth is enormous. And it's already coming not out of the market system now, which is what caused the inequality before the financial crisis. It's now coming out of the impact of government policy. And this is really the ineffectiveness of government policy led by mainstream economists who have no idea of the role of inequality, really, in society. Most of their models talk about a representative agent where they lump together income from wages and income from profits as if we both receive them equally. So that level of naivety lies behind policies that believe we can revive the economies by boosting the wealth of the wealthy.
In the meantime, the workers may have to wait for a decade to be able to recover the losses they sustained. The report also estimates between 200 million to 500 million people may have fallen into poverty during 2020. Oxfam has said in its report that the world's billionaires' collective net worth is now standing at nearly $12 trillion, equivalent to what G20 countries have spent in response to the pandemic. The most vulnerable workers have faced some of the biggest job losses throughout the pandemic's recovery, and that K-shaped trajectory may continue.
And this is Ben Bernanke, who's on record as saying this, thought one way to revive the economy was to increase the value of shares and cause what he calls a wealth effect to encourage more spending and stimulate the economy. And I summarise that as trying to make the economy better by making the wealthy wealthier, because only a tiny fraction of the population owns shares, and that boosted their wealth without touching what happened with the remainder. Now, when COVID has struck, a very similar process is afoot. Central banks are buying bonds again, giving the financial sector large amounts of cash, which they then use to buy shares, which drives up share prices. and that's what's causing what's called the K-shaped recovery. Asset markets, particularly share markets, are skyrocketing, while at the same time, because workers can't go to work due to lockdowns and the impact of COVID, the income of workers is falling.
The International Labour Organization said there were some encouraging signs of recovery at the start of 2021, with the COVID-19 vaccine gradually being deployed around the world. However, it's still estimated the continuing economic fallout would lead to a 3% loss of working hours globally in 2021, compared with the end of 2019, equivalent to 19 million full-time jobs. In a pessimistic scenario, which assumes slow progress on vaccination, working hours would fall by 4.6% this year, while in an optimistic path, the world economy would still lose 1.3% of working hours. The outcome would depend on how well the pandemic was brought under control and by how much consumer and business confidence recovered. A slow vaccine rollout and uneven distribution could also impact the speed at which the global economy recovers. This has led the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund to downgrade their respective outlooks. It seems that the only way out of the current economic situation for the governments around the world is aiming for a targeted recovery that prioritizes employment and would provide support for hard-hit workers and sectors.
Bangladesh's government sent another group of Rohingya Muslim refugees to a remote and deserted island in the Bay of Bengal. More than 1,400 refugees set sail for the island of Basanchar. It was the fourth group sent to the island, and the Bangladeshi government plans to eventually move 100,000 Rohingya to the remote island. Bangladesh also aims to decongest refugee camps in Cox's Bazar, which shelters approximately 1 million Rohingya. The relocations began in December and have been criticized by human rights groups who say that many of the refugees are being forced to move against their will. The government of Bangladesh says the relocation is voluntary, but many refugees have talked about the move as being coerced. Rights organizations say the Bangladeshi government used cash incentives as well as intimidation tactics to force Rohingya to accept the relocation offer. Bangladeshi authorities say the relocation is essential to ensure better living conditions for the refugees and to improve the camps in Cox's Bazar.
As a matter of fact, Bangladesh and India were among the countries which from the beginning opposed the incoming of these refugees. As a matter of fact, they identified them as terrorists and they did not give them what their rights under international law and under the humanitarian law as refugees. And we've seen that it's continuing. They see the Rohingya Muslims as a problem rather than sort of oppressed people that they need to be supported at this hour of need.
The refugee camp became overcrowded from August 2017, when Rohingya Muslims began fleeing their homes in Rakhine State following waves of attacks by Myanmar's army and Buddhist mobs. Hundreds of thousands of Muslims were violently uprooted in the months that followed, driven by a brutal military crackdown that killed thousands of them. What happened in August 2017 was so horrific that the UN called it genocide and a textbook example of ethnic cleansing. Those who survived the brutal killings sought refuge in Bangladesh and neighboring countries, hoping for a day to return home. But for now, it seems that thousands of them have to go on yet another perilous journey. The Rohingya are the world's most persecuted ethnic minority, haunted by the past and denied a future. A citizenship law in 1982 stripped them of their nationality, making them one of the world's largest stateless communities. While there have been waves of exodus to Bangladesh since the 1970s, none was as rapid and massive as the one in August 2017 that turned the spotlight on the Rohingya crisis around the world. Today, Bangladesh alone is home to nearly a million Rohingya refugees. At least half of those who arrived in the country were children. The UN says the migration was unprecedented in terms of volume and speed. These people know that they cannot stay in Cox's Bazar forever. But it seems that they are not wanted anywhere in this world.
Well, they're not really stateless in reality. They have a right to be its citizens of Myanmar, they've been denied that basic fundamental right. It's not the fact that, you know, by history, they are stateless. Their citizenship has been denied, and you're absolutely right. That is the heart of the problem. And it will not be resolved unless the international community force the Myanmar government to rise up and accept their responsibility for looking after their own citizens.
There were talks of the Rohingya repatriation for the past couple of years, but to this day, nothing has happened. The main reason is that Myanmar's government was always unwilling to accept the refugees. Bangladesh has time and again pushed hard to begin the repatriation, but Myanmar has been delaying it, saying that it needs more time for logistical arrangements. The Rohingya Muslims also fear for their safety in case they return to their country. The UN fact-finding mission in Myanmar says that approximately 600,000 Rohingya are still inside the country, living under the threat of genocide. The world body says no refugees will agree to be repatriated without assurance of full citizenship, ethnic rights, to settle back in Myanmar. Given the Myanmar's leaders' reluctance to address the issue, the minority group's fate is a major cause for concern that is only being voiced by a select group of countries around the world.
Muhammad is my guide, Muhammad is my teacher, Muhammad my beloved Rasul.
I want to be like you.
Like you.
In everything I do, Ya Rasulallah.
I want to walk like you, talk like you, read my Quran just like you.
And we have not sent you, but as a mercy to the world.
I want to be a servant of God like Muhammad.
Be like Muhammad, live like Muhammad, see like Muhammad did. Muhammad, Rasulullah.
A'udhu billahi min shaitan ar-rajim, bismillahir rahmanir rahim. Dear brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Welcome to Like Muhammad. I am Javed Akbari, and we are going to talk about Allama Tabatabai's Sunan al-Nabi. This is, of course, a book written by Allama Tabatabai, who is one of the great scholars. And Sunan al-Nabi is about the narrations of the Prophet and conducts and customs of the noble Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and his family. The Quran is the book of guidance. ذَلِكَ الْكِتَابُ لَا رَيْبَ فِيهِ هُدًى لِلْمُتَّقِينَ. In the religion of Islam, most of the actions and deeds, especially the acts of worship, are accompanied by some etiquette and special manners. There is a report from Ibn Abbas who says that whenever the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, recited سَبِّحْ اسْمَ رَبِّكَ الْأَعْلَى or chapter 87 of the Holy Quran, because this is the chapter Al-A'la, which begins with سَبِّحْ اسْمَ رَبِّكَ الْأَعْلَى, and whenever he recited this chapter, he would say سُبْحَانَ رَبِّي الْأَعْلَى. Okay, he would say it when he recited this chapter. Now, this teaches us the adab, the etiquette of reciting the Holy Quran and reciting the different verses of the Holy Quran. We discussed in the previous episode that the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, used to recite the Musabbihat. And he used to recite Surat Al-Mulk, Surat Alif Lam Mim, or Surah Sajda, which is Surah 32 of the Holy Quran. As I said, these are the surahs which the Holy Prophet recited every now and then, because he either liked those verses, or because there are secrets behind these verses, and there are tremendous rewards for reciting these verses, and that was why the Holy Prophet recited them. So let's go further ahead. When the Prophet recited Sabbih Asma Rabbika al-A'la, he would say Subhana Rabbi al-A'la. Okay. And this tradition, this report has also been transmitted by Imam Ali alayhi salatu was salam. In Ad-Dur al-Manthur, written by Suyuti, there's a report from Abi Umama. Suyuti is a Sunni scholar, and he has written a book, a very well-known book, titled Ad-Dur al-Manthur. Now, there in this book, there is a report from Abi Umama, who said, I prayed with the Holy Prophet. Obviously, Abi Umama was one of the companions of the Holy Prophet. And he says that I prayed with the Holy Prophet after his last pilgrimage, Hajjatul Wada. And he used to frequently recite, La Uqsimu Bi Yawmil Qiyamah. Now, Surah Al-Qiyamah is Surah 75 of the Holy Quran. And when he recited this Surah of the Holy Quran, he would recite this also, Alaysa Dhalika Biqadirin Ala An Yuhya Al-Mawta. Is he not able to give life to the dead? This is also in the same Surah Al-Qiyamah, Surah 35. When he recited this Surah of the Quran in the very chapter, then he would say, Bala, wa ana ala dhalika min ash-shahidin. Yes, indeed, and I am a witness to this. Now, this verse of the Holy Quran, Alaysa dhalika biqadirin ala an yuhyi al-mawta, this is a question directed to the reader of the Holy Quran, that is God not able to revive the dead or to give life to the dead?
Is to be with you.
Allahumma salli ala Sayyidina Mustafa ala Habibika Nabika Mustafa. Allahumma salli ala Sayyidina
Mustafa.
If you understand this Quran, of course, you will in your heart, you will admit and you will confess that, of course, God is the one who gives lives to the dead. God is the one who creates. God is the one who sustains. Now, the Prophet, when he came and reached, and when he recited this verse of the Holy Quran, he would say, Bala, indeed, wa ana ala dhalika min ash-shahidin. I'm a witness to this. The verse is actually a reminder of the fact that God is omnipotent. He is all-powerful. He creates and He gives life. And He it is who takes back the life. هُوَ الَّذِي يُحْيِي وَيُمِيتُ فَإِذَا قَضَى أَمْرًا فَإِنَّمَا يَقُولُ لَهُ كُنْ فَيَكُونَ Chapter Al-Ghafir, Ayah 68, Chapter 40. هو الذي يحيي ويميت فإذا قضى أمرا فإنما يقول له كن فيكون. He it is who gives life and brings death. So when he decrees an affair, he only says to it, be and it is. Okay? So there's no doubt as to the fact that it is Allah alone who gives life and who takes back the life. Okay? Now this is one of the code of conduct. This is one of the manners associated with the recitation of the Holy Quran, that when we recite the Holy Quran, we should understand it and we should confess it, we should acknowledge it with our heart, and we should testify it. Of course, it's not obligatory to do all this, but it is recommendation. Adab is not always obligatory. Some of the adab are obligatory, some of the etiquettes are obligatory, others are recommended. Now, there is also another report from Ibn Abbas. Ibn Abbas was also one of the companions of the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, who said, when the Holy Prophet would recite the ayah, وَنَفْسِ وَمَا سَوَّاهَا فَأَلْهَمَهَا فُجُورَهَا وَتَقْوَاهَا, and the soul and he who made it perfect, then he inspired it, understand what is right and what is wrong. When the Holy Prophet recited this verse, وَنَفْسِ وَمَا سَوَهَا فَأَلْهَمَهَا فُجُورَهَا وَتَقْوَاهَا, he would stop and then say, اللَّهُمَّ آتِ نَفْسِي تَقْوَاهَا وَزَكَّاهَا أَنْتَ خَيْرٌ مَنْ زَكَّاهَا أَنْتَ وَلِيُّهَا وَمَوْلَاهَا. O Allah, give my soul piety and God consciousness and purify it, for you are the best of those who purify it. You are its Lord and Master. Okay? So, to put it in a nutshell, to make a long story short, the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, when he recited this verse of chapter 40, verse 68, okay, he would say, when he recited, هو الذي يحيي ويميت, when he recited, ونفسي وما سواها فألهمها فجورها وتقواها, then he would say, اللهم آتي نفسي تقواها, O Allah, give my soul piety, وزكاها أنت خير من زكاها, and you purify it because you are the best of those who purify it. أنت وليها ومولاها, you are it is Lord and you are it is Master. Okay, so the Prophet, peace be upon him, would testify to whatever Allah the Almighty said to says or in the Holy Quran. He would acknowledge by confirming it, by testifying to it. And of course the Holy Prophet would do this while he was in Salah. Okay, this is what we read in Sunan al-Nabi, written by Allama Tabatabai. May Allah bless his soul. Inshallah, we will further discuss this, the adab of reciting the Holy Quran, in the following episode. Until then, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Be like Muhammad, live like Muhammad, see like Muhammad. Be like Muhammad and live like Muhammad and give like Muhammad gave. Shafi'ullah, Habibullah, Nabiullah, Rasulullah, Khalilullah, my friend Allah, Ya Rasulullah, Rasulullah.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
the limelight.
While 122 countries voted to ban nuclear weapons, the United States pursued a project to threaten China with a nuclear attack. In August of 2019, the United States withdrew from the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces, or INF, treaty, tested two intermediate-range missiles, and then posted an order for a variety of cruise and ballistic missiles. When the U.S. government sought bases for these missiles around China, its Asian allies balked. They do not want to inflame the already tense situation between the United States and China. The article you're about to hear has been written by Vijay Prashad, an Indian historian, editor, and journalist. The piece is titled, "We Can't Give Up, an Idea of a Nuke-Free World." The article has been taken from the Asia Times website. Please stay with us for more of Vijay Prashad's article. On 22nd of January, the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons became international law for the 122 states that signed the agreement in July of 2017. The Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, as with most treaties, is summed up in one sentence, Article 1A. Each state party undertakes never, under any circumstances, to develop, test, produce, manufacture, otherwise acquire, possess or stockpile nuclear weapons or other nuclear explosive devices. There is no complexity here. This is a treaty to ban nuclear weapons. Wilfred Burchard was the first non-Japanese journalist to visit Hiroshima after the atomic bombing of that city. His first dispatch for London's The Daily Express on 5th of September 1945 was titled "The Atomic Plague." Wilfred Burchett wrote, "In Hiroshima, 30 days after the first atomic bomb destroyed the city and shook the world, people are still dying, mysteriously and horribly. Hiroshima does not look like a bomb city. It looks as if a monster steamroller had passed over it and squashed it out of existence." Wilfred Burchett said, "I write these facts as dispassionately as I can, in the hope that they will act as a warning to the world. The damage is far greater than photographs can show. It gives you an empty feeling in the stomach to see such man-made devastation." In 1952, Sakamoto Hatsumi, a primary school pupil who had experienced the terror of the bombing, wrote a short poem. "When the atomic bomb drops, day turns into night, people turn into ghosts. It is simple and elegant, a plea from the darkness to abolish nuclear weapons." This is what the Hibakusha, the survivors of the atomic nightmare of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, have been demanding since 1945. Their pleas have been heard around the world, but not in the capitals that have developed these hideous weapons. 9 of the 193 member states of the United Nations possess nuclear weapons. One of them, the United States of America, has more than half of all the 13,410 warheads. Four countries, namely the United States, Russia, Britain and France, have at least 1,800 warheads on high alert, which means that they can be fired at very short notice. To compare the warheads currently deployed with the atom bomb dropped on Hiroshima is enough to make the heart stop. The yield from the little boy used on Hiroshima has been estimated at 15 kilotons, whereas the yield from one W-88 warhead that is deployed on a Trident II submarine is estimated at 475 kilotons. It is not just the number of nuclear weapons that are available. The current nuclear weapons, many of them deployed on submarines and ships, are far more lethal. None of the 9 nuclear weapon states have joined the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. They boycotted the negotiations and the vote in the United Nations General Assembly. In October of 2020, the United States government circulated a letter asking those governments that signed the treaty to withdraw from it. The U.S. ambassador to the United Nations in 2017, Nikki Haley, claimed that the Treaty on Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons threatened the security of the United States. She condescended to the 122 governments that joined the Treaty on Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, saying, "Do they really understand the threats that we have?" As Prabir Purukayaspa, an engineer and a science activist in the power, telecommunications and software sector, wrote in January of 2020, over the course of the past few years, the U.S. administration has undermined the 3 core treaties for disarmament: the Anti-Ballistic Missile, or ABM, Treaty, the Intermediate Range Nuclear Forces, or INF, Treaty, and the Strategic Arms Limitation Treaty, which has now metamorphosed into the Strategic Arms Reduction Treaty, or START. Appetite for serious nuclear disarmament has simply not been evident. In fact, the Congressional Budget Office, CBO, in the United States estimates that the government will spend $1.2 trillion between 2017 and 2046 to modernize the U.S. nuclear arsenal. The other 8 nuclear weapon states will follow suit, but far behind, since in these matters the United States drives this terrifying agenda. While 122 countries voted to ban nuclear weapons, the United States pursued a project to threaten China with nuclear attack. In August of 2019, the U.S. withdrew from the INF Treaty, tested 2 intermediate-range missiles, and then posted an order for a variety of cruise and ballistic missiles. When the U.S. government sought bases for these missiles around China, its Asian allies balked. They do not want to inflame the already tense situation between Washington and Beijing. Former U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said in 2020 that the Department of Defense has ramped up its efforts against China. These threats grew more and more explicit later that year. President Joe Biden's new Secretary of State, Anthony Blinken, said Donald Trump's administration was right to be tough on China. The presence of these missiles on U.S. naval vessels and the development of hypersonic cruise missiles, as well as open threats against China, simply make it impossible for Beijing to dismantle its nuclear arsenal. To do so would be tantamount to surrender before a U.S. attack. Meanwhile, China's government has said that it welcomes the establishment of nuclear-free zones, including the Southeast Asian Nuclear Weapon-Free Zone Treaty. At a press briefing in July of 2020, Fu Kong, Director General of China's Department of Arms Control and Disarmament in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, said his country would be willing to enter disarmament negotiations if the U.S. arsenal at 5,800 nuclear missiles dropped down to the Chinese level of about 300 nuclear missiles. Fu Kong said the U.S. knows full well the huge gap between the Chinese and American nuclear arsenals, both in terms of quantity and sophistication, adding, "For the U.S., hyping up the China factor is nothing but a ploy to divert world attention and to create a pretext under which they could walk away from the new START treaty, as they have done on so many other arms control treaties. Fukong noted, "The real purpose is to get rid of all possible restrictions and have a free hand in seeking overwhelming military superiority over any adversary, real or imagined." Public opinion, even in many NATO countries, favors a total ban on nuclear weapons. After a treaty for prohibition of nuclear weapons went into force on 22nd of January this year, Beatrice Fein of the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons addressed nuclear weapon states. She said, "Your weapons are now banned, permanently. You are on the wrong side of international law, the wrong side of history, and the wrong side of humanity." In 2017, the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons won the Nobel Peace Prize. Nuclear disarmament has a long history. In 1961, the US and the former Soviet Union signed the McCloy-Zorin Accords, or the Agreed Principles for General and Complete Disarmament, which called for general and complete disarmament, but also that war should no longer be an instrument for settling international problems. Gone is that spirit, but it needs to be revived.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Husayn, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
قال الإمام الباقر عليه السلام أثقل ما يوضع في الميزان يوم القيامة الصلاة على محمد وعلى أهل بيته.
Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam stated, "The heaviest thing to be placed on the scales on the day of resurrection is the invocation of blessings on Muhammad and his household."
Welcome back, dear listeners. It's an honor to have you with us. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. Dear friends, when talking about excellent and beautiful conversations,
which have taken place between the infallibles and their students or their companions or their fellow men and women in the communities and in the nation, we find a very interesting conversation in the historical books. Now, this golden conversation is between Jabir al-Jufi and Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam. In this beautiful conversation, we find that there are many different things which Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, peace be upon him, talks about with Jabir al-Jufi in this very interesting conversation, which is full of these exemplary moral standards and beautiful ideals. Now, one of the things that Imam al-Baqir says to Jabir al-Jufi in this conversation is that there is no abasement, no humiliation like the abasement of greediness. Even though this is a very short statement, truly it is very profound. And it is these kind of golden conversations between the infallibles and their companions or their friends, which have remained and have been preserved for thousands of years. In this beautiful statement of this conversation, we find that Imam al-Baqir said, the worst kind of abasement, the worst kind of humiliation, the worst kind of feeling and becoming low is when you are humiliated because of greediness. And is this not true, dear friends? When one is greedy, it seems like whatever you have is never enough. You always need more and more and more. And it gets to a point eventually where you are willing to do everything and anything to attain that desire of greed. And so surely there is no abasement, there is no humiliation like the humiliation of greediness. Beautiful ethical standards put forth in this conversation between Jabir al-Jufi and Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. I am Atta, the host of the program Dialogue. Now, this moment, I invite you to listen to a short speech by Sheikh Ayyub Rashid. I hope you enjoy this part and stay tuned till the end of today's program.
Now, when we talk about Shia identity, there was a companion of Imam alayhi salam by the name Jabir al-Jufi. Jabir al-Jufi, he was a companion of Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam. One day, he was talking to Imam and he was like, I want to know who is a Shia. Can you give me the characteristics, the identities of Shia? Imam alayhi salam then mentioned, Ya Jabir, yaktafi man ittakhadha at-tashayyu'a an yaqula bihubbina ahli al-bayt. Is it sufficient for someone who claims to be a Shia to say that I love Ahlul Bayt alayhim salam? Is it sufficient? Then Imam alayhi salam made a statement. He said, Fa wallahi, I swear by God, Ma shi'atuna illa man ittaqa Allah. Indeed, our Shia are those who fear Allah. They have taqwa. Wa ata'ah, and he obeys Allah. Wa ma kanu yu'rafuna illa bitawadu'i wattakhashu'. Shia, our Shia are those who are known by humility and humbleness. These are our Shias. Wa ada'il amana. Our Shias are those who, when you trust them with something, they will be entrusted and they will keep the amana. Wa kathrati dhikrillah. They are known by remembering Allah a lot. Wasawmi, they are known by fasting a lot. Wasalati, they are known by praying a lot. Walbirri bilwalidain, and they are kind to their parents. وَالتَّعَهُدِ لِلْجِيرَانِ مِنَ الْفُقَرَاءِ وَأَهْلِ الْمَسْكَنَةِ وَالْغَارِمِينَ. And they are good to their neighbors. They help the neighbors who are poor, destitute, and who needs help. Our Shias, they are known by their help. Wal Aitam, they help those who are orphans. Wasidqil Hadith, they speak that which is truth. Watilawatil Quran, they read Quran a lot. Wakafil al Suni anin nasi illa min khair, they don't talk about other people except that which is good.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
Biden's newly unveiled U.S. Citizenship Act of 2021 provides clues to how he is likely to address border enforcement going forward, as construction machinery at the southern border sits idle. Instead of a steel barrier, Biden's legislative proposal would deploy even more technology to the border, accelerating the creation of a smart wall powered by biometric data, artificial intelligence, facial recognition, aerial drones, infrared cameras, motion sensors, and radar. In this regard, we have prepared an article for you written by Candice Burnrider. This article is published under the heading, Biden is rejecting Trump's border wall, but favors his own technological wall. Stay tuned for the details. U.S. President Joe Biden will sign a number of immigration-related executive actions, continuing his reversals of former President Donald Trump's harsh policies toward undocumented immigrants, asylum seekers, and refugees as part of the new administration's effort to pursue a more humanitarian approach to immigration and border enforcement. However, at least one of Biden's proposals suggests that while he rejects Trump's big, beautiful wall approach, he favors a different kind of wall, a ramping up of technology-driven surveillance at the border. Biden terminated Trump's national emergency declaration at the southern border and ordered a pause on all construction work on Trump's wall on his first day, to the relief of border communities like those in Laredo, Texas, fighting to protect their lands and cultural heritage. Still, Biden's newly unveiled U.S. Citizenship Act of 2021 provides clues to how he is likely to address border enforcement going forward, as construction machinery at the southern border sits idle. Instead of a steel barrier, Biden's legislative proposal would deploy even more technology to the border, accelerating the creation of a smart wall powered by biometric data, artificial intelligence, facial recognition, aerial drones, infrared cameras, motion sensors, and radar. The legislation's full text has yet to be released, but a fact sheet contains a section titled Supplement Existing Border Resources with Technology and Infrastructure, which says the bill builds on record budget allocations for immigration enforcement by authorizing additional funding for the Secretary of DHS to develop and implement a plan to deploy technology to expedite screening and enhance the ability to process asylum seekers. Additionally, White House Press Secretary Jen Psaki told reporters on January 21st that Biden's approach to border security will be multi-pronged. It is to do smart security, security that will help address and use technology to address key border crossings, address ports of entry more effectively and efficiently, and putting that oversight in the hands of the DHS. Biden and other border area Democrats like Laredo Representative Henry Kaler have long favored a virtual wall over a physical barrier. In fact, Biden's campaign immigration plan blasted Trump for failing to invest in a smarter border technology and promised to invest in cameras, sensors, large-scale X-ray machines, and fixed towers at the southern border. Immigration rights activists have reason to be cautious when it comes to how his administration will handle technology and border enforcement. They have condemned Biden for partnering with and including a number of Silicon Valley executives in his administration. Overall, we were excited to see the Biden administration want to take decisive action on immigration, but I think there is a lot of concerns and red flags about the way border security is framed and also the kind of very chummy relationship between the tech industry and the administration overall, says Jacinta Gonzalez, who is senior campaign organizer with Mi Gente, a grassroots organization which campaigns against tech companies that enable Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, to track and arrest undocumented people. Congress has already appropriated $28 million to U.S. Customs and Border Protection, CBP, to construct 30 additional autonomous surveillance towers used for round-the-clock automated surveillance operations that identify people and vehicles at a border. Nearly $2 billion was allocated for additional border wall, but that funding is now being re-evaluated during Biden's 60-day pause and is likely to be redirected toward virtual security technology. I really hope the proportions for border wall projects do not go back to DHS and the appropriations just kind of expire, says Robert Lopez.